Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them.
Disrespect welcomes Simon Black, a researcher at the City Institute at York University. Simon's going to talk to us about economic consequences and lost opportunities from failing to invest in marginally disadvantaged and low-income people, aren't you?
Yes, thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me again.
Okay. How'd you like that site, Do the Math?
The spot's done an excellent campaign, and it's really publicized the need for increases in welfare rates and ODSP rates in Ontario.
Oh, so you were familiar with this site before I pointed it out to you?
Yes, okay. Yeah. I was familiar with the campaign and the whole idea of increasing rates in order to have people who are living on social assistance and ODSP to live healthy and dignified lives, which they can't do now at current rates. We know that rates for a single on OW is, I think it's $592 a month, and a single on ODSP is about $1,053 or thereabouts.
Yeah.
We still haven't recovered.
Cut back the special diet.
And the special diet. And, if we have a chance to talk more about it, I think that the special diet in particular has been very significant.
Oh.
And I think it's significant in a number of ways. First, it was money that people could access to make living on social assistance a little bit easier.
Which offended the government so much, their doctors agreed they all needed.
Well, this is what happened with the campaign, is that for people that don't know, for any of your listeners that don't know about the campaign, I'll just
yeah, a lot of people are still unfamiliar with it.
So in March 2005, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty began the campaign in earnest. And the idea was that the special diet allowance, which was for people with special dietary needs on ODSP or OW, could access up to $250 extra per month in payment to cover their dietary needs.
Right.
Now, this wasn't well known, and this is typical of welfare systems, not only in Canada, but, across the industrialized world. Welfare bureaucracies like to look good on paper, but how they actually work when you're in the welfare office and how welfare clients can get access or know about what's available to them is often something, just like when they try to divert you from applying in the first place, it's often something that the welfare bureaucracies make it very difficult for you to know and to be able to access something like the special diet. So OCAP knew about the special diet, and it was widely kind of publicized through their activist networks in Ontario. And they started signing people up in clinics and getting, it was midwives, RNs, doctors, and dietitians to sign off on the forms and approve people for this extra money, the special diet allowance.
Yeah.
A big development came in May 2005 when the Daily Bread Food Bank passed a motion supporting the special diet campaign.
Right.
So this meant that clinics were going to be set up in the Daily Bread's various food banks throughout the GTA, and the motion said that all people should have access by virtue of being poor and having poor diets as a result of being poor, should have access to the special diet.
Mm-hmm.
So by summer of 2005, there was you saw the backlash from the government, and there was more and more welfare offices were denying the special diet to to those who have been approved by a medical practitioner.
I think Sandra Pupatello was the minister at that time.
Right, I think it was Pupatello. You saw this at the municipal level. I know we're talking Hamilton Community Radio, but in Toronto, the applications became more complicated the more people were signing up for it. You know, the bureaucracy went to work.
They changed it many times.
They did, and this is something that's been continuous up until today. It's changing the administration of the diet to make it harder for people to actually to get access to it.
Right.
But it didn't work for them in the sense that by 2007 now, so it starts in 2005, fast forward to 2007, you have about 31,000 people getting the special diet allowance in the province, and that was up from about 5,300 in 2002.
Right.
What this meant for the government in terms of its budget was that this program, which was not well known, that very few people had access to or knowledge of, went from being a program of cost of $6 million a year till the kind of peak of the campaign in 2009, 2010, it was costing the government $250 million a year.
Right.
To pay out the special diet allowance. Yeah. Now, this is huge because this is a campaign, a grassroots campaign by poor people and poor people's organizations to win money from the government. And we know rates were...
I just have to add, money to eat.
Money to eat, yeah. You know, money to eat. And the rates, we know the rates were cut by Mike Harris back in 95 by 22%, and there wasn't much movement. When the McGuinty government was elected, the Liberals were elected in 2003. Small changes in social assistance rates that didn't even keep up with inflation.
Right.
So this campaign showed that when poor people mobilized and came together, and it was through their kind of own ingenuity and got access to this, that the government was going to have to pay out, you know, in upwards of $230-240 million. To poor people across the province.
Right.
So it was very significant. In the GTA alone, I think it's up to 20% of people on OW or ODSP by 2009, 2010 had access to the special diet allowance.
Yeah. Well, I know doctors feel that it's an entitlement now. They don't feel this should be reserved for people who only have special medical needs. Yes, they should get the full value for it, but by virtue of their income and their diet, and they're accumulating ill health, everybody on Ontario fixed incomes should get access to the special diet, and doctors are prepared to all but lie to get you on the roaster. And the McGuinty government may have crossed the line. The doctors may be willing to lie now. I don't know. I haven't spoken to a doctor since this happened about the special diet.
Some doctors, there's one doctor in particular, and he was actually... Brought forth the...
What was his name again?
Roland Wong.
Okay.
Brought forward in front of the regulatory bodies, the Ontario Medical College of Doctors, or whatever the regulatory bodies called for doctors in the province. And
College of Physicians and Surgeons.
College, that's it. And they threatened to revoke his license on the basis that he was misdiagnosing people.
Right.
And a lot of doctors, like you said, a lot of doctors and nurses and nurse practitioners and dietitians who are cognizant of all this literature and research around the social determinants of health, you know, not necessarily having a particular ailment or disease or
right.
need for a special diet. You need the special diet, but just by virtue of being poor.
Yeah.
And that, you know, as one of the key social determinants of health is poverty. So a lot of medical practitioners took part in the campaign on that basis. Now, there was an Auditor General's report that came out, I think it was in November of 2010, and the Auditor General of Ontario made an announcement that was really reminiscent of the kind of Harris years, talking about kind of widespread fraud in the welfare system,
right.
based on her analysis of what had gone on with the special diet.
Oh, and when was this?
This was November 2010. The Auditor General released a report, and this is when the McGuinty government really decided that it needed to clamp down on this program and committed to eliminating the program in it's since backed off that, but committed to eliminating the program in March.
I got an interesting perspective from an advocate on eliminating the program. The Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act, which the McGuinty government was embarrassed into introducing in the legislature, and it did pass, would, if you stop the special diet, they would call that a retaliation, and the penalties for the government and the ministers for that would be ordered by Canadian Human Rights Commission, a federal organization. They couldn't contest them, and they'd be horrendous. They lose their homes, they lose their cars, they lose whatever of their pensions was vulnerable. So they couldn't, they couldn't stop the special diet because of the law that they had concocted, but were embarrassed into passing when a couple of advocates in Hamilton walked on stage while the minister was presenting and asked them in front of the audience outright if she was going to pass the act. And that's when she put her foot in it and said yes, and subsequently left the provincial Liberal government, but left us with this act. And she's now trying to get back into federal politics. Marie Bontragiani.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was quite a story. I didn't know that inside story.
Yeah, and I mean, there was a lot more going on, too, that I think in February 2010, so just this past year, the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal made a judgment saying that the government was discriminating against people on social assistants who are accessing the special diet. And I think this is one of the, I mean, that tribunal and then the continuing campaign of doctors and some of the unions coming on board.
Wow.
And the Daily Bread Food Bank being involved. I think that created the momentum that really eventually backed the government away from canceling the special diet or eliminating it altogether, which was the initial response. Was to get rid of the diet, and then they said they were going to kind of give it over to the Ministry of Health to do some nutritional supplement or, you know, something very abstract.
Yeah.
But the new system that they developed is going to come into effect April 1st, and if you read what poor people and advocates, anti-poverty advocates in the province are saying, that it's a victory that the special diet remains, but the special diet in its current manifestation as of April 1st is going to be very limited. So they've eliminated some of the conditions.
Yep.
They've made it harder to access. More kind of more invasive, which is kind of typical of the welfare.
Invasive in what way?
Invasive in having to disclose medical history or history of mental health or.
Really.
Whatever it may be.
I haven't looked closely at the form. I think I've got it on me, but it's kind of like something radioactive. I don't want to pull it out where I'm exposed to it, sort of thing.
Right. So the struggle continues when it comes to the special diet. But I think the government's reaction is really indicative of, you know, I think we'd have to ask, first of all, why was the special diet campaign such a threat? Because you had poor people mobilizing and controlling and shaping the welfare system on their own terms.
Yeah.
Not on the terms of the government, not on the terms of an appointed committee that's going to do a social assistance review.
Well, with the implicit collaboration of food security organizations, doctors, nurses, dietitians, RNs, you name it, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody's going, yeah, this is a good thing. And the government's going,
very broad.
We don't want to spend that money. And everybody's going,
a very
going,
broad
you
coalition.
It. You got it, yeah.
Yeah, it was a very very broad coalition of different groups and actors.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it was seen as such a threat. I think the government is, you know, the government's introduced its poverty reduction strategy. I think it kind of deals with groups like 25 and 5 or Campaign 2000. That's the respectable anti-poverty lobby.
Mm-hmm.
But when poor people actually mobilized to win this special diet through the OCAP campaign and through the cooperation of Daily Bread, then that's a problem, because you have people taking control over a system that is notoriously and historically has been about controlling them.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think that doesn't get talked about a lot. I mean, people talk about the numbers and how much, you know, how much special diet should be or this, that, and the other dietary condition.
Yeah.
But I think there's a more kind of fundamental point, and that's when people actually start to control the system themselves, when poor people can, then that's something the government doesn't like.
Well, yeah. You go out to your Lincoln or your Cadillac and, you know, your chauffeur's waiting and you get taken down to Queen's Park and then you sit down in the hall with all the tradition behind it and everything, and then there are poor people telling you what to do. How off-putting is this?
That's an affront to the dignity of the elite.
The dignity of the elite, yeah, that's what's really at stake here.
With respect for Gary Moore, this is Walking by Myself.
I don't imagine you've heard, and I would imagine it's pretty hush-hush. Most people would probably be taking an attitude to remedy this situation of the government will find out when we hit them with it. And so I imagine there are a number of initiatives underway, but I've probed around to some people who would know, lawyers and others, and I get silence, you know. And I don't think silence is indifference. I have a feeling silence is, yeah, I know, but nobody wants to make it public yet. So I have a feeling some surprises are being prepared again for the McGuinty government. I don't know. I have no inside information on this. Except
are you talking about from the movement side of things? Or
yeah,
from the actual government?
I think surprises for them too, but mine aren't nearly as spectacular as what I think other people will launch.
Right. I think come spring, we will see a kind of redoubling of efforts around the special diet and just the anti-poverty agenda in general.
With an election in the offing, there are new opportunities for the movement, too.
There is.
Yeah.
There is.
Yeah.
And I think it's a perfect time to shame this government.
Yeah.
And to show voters. There's a lot of, I mean, that the whole Harris agenda around cutting welfare, really, it is.
But it's
money on the fact that the majority of the population in Ontario, we're going to think that labeling people, poor people and people with disability, cheaters and fraudsters and undeserving of government assistance was going to work. And maybe there was some truth to that, that was the environment, you know, in 1995, but I don't think
regardless of the truth, it worked for a while. But if you keep saying for 16 years we're going to wring the fraud out of the system, there comes a point where all but the most cynical voters say, "I don't know, you've been wringing this thing for 16 years,
right.
Isn't it dead yet?" You know.
And I think that's exactly the case. And I think when you see, you know, welfare rolls increase because of the economic crisis and higher levels of unemployment that we've had over the past couple of years.
Yeah.
And now the government is not just going to be attacking those who are on OW and ODSP. This whole response to the economic crisis, which really, you know, begins in the financial sector in the United States and ends up being a crisis, you know, crisis of ourselves, a crisis of poor and working people, where the government has decided that in order to pay back, you know, to get that money, that's owed to the
very rich. Just a minute, there's something moving in my pocket here. Oh, my God, it's a hand. Yeah.
The crisis is going to be paid on the backs of poor and working people, and it's going to be cutbacks to social programs.
Yeah.
And you see with the public sector wage freeze in Ontario, this is something, and that can only kind of strengthen the anti-poverty movement in the sense that more people are going to feel under the cosh by this government as it looks to deal with the deficits that they say we so desperately need to address.
It's an interesting point you've raised because we get an unusual perspective of it in Hamilton. We have thousands of steel workers locked out by United States Steel, and the federal government has agreed to extend to them employment insurance benefits, which is something they theoretically didn't have to do. And yet, on the other hand, you have the McGuinty government saying, don't fall off the other end or we'll cut your food, man. And the question comes up, who are the social conservatives? It doesn't seem to be the Federal Conservative Party as much as it seems to be the Ontario Liberal Party. They are the real social conservatives. Man, have we got some new industrial bailouts and new taxes for you guys. You know, better get back on the job. And everybody's just, you know, holding picket signs and looking at one another and wondering where this comes from. Who's lost touch here?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's the way Hudak is trying to portray McGuinty, as a man out of touch. And it, you know, because of these kinds of actions, it may stick.
I mean, I think he's definitely out of touch, but we don't want the kind of in touch that Hudak represents either.
I don't think anybody knows what Hudak represents. I think that's the problem. I mean, you could question his being in touch because he's not given any evidence of being in or out of touch. He's just sort of dancing in the shadows at this point. They have a convention coming up apparently late this spring, which should reveal a little bit more. But
I think he did a flip-flop already, didn't he?
I'm trying to think of what it was. Rolling back the health tax for your OHIP card. He swore he was going to do it, and then when pressed hard about it, it was, well, wait and see.
I think we'll see when that convention is held that the Liberals and the Conservatives will have very similar platforms. I mean, there'll be some things around the edges will be different. But the general kind of thrust of their campaign platforms and of their strategies is going to be about balancing the books on the backs of the majority of the population.
So it boils down to which leader you vote for boils down to whether you want cheaper beer or not, apparently.
Yeah. And we'll have to see how the NDP can respond to that as well.
Well, even Hudak, I think it's pretty clear he's covering his tracks in case he needs the NDP to form a working minority. But even he's been saying, well, Andrea and I come from the same sort of ethnic background, and we're not too different in age, and I know what she's had to go through to build up this party, and I think she's done a fine job. And yeah, I know, right?
It's very odd what's happening here.
And it's an opportunity McGuinty hasn't taken. So a number of pundits have been postulating. Do pundits postulate that what we may end up with is a minority Conservative or Liberal government with the NDP in the catbird seat? I don't know what that would do with the budget we have. I don't know what that would do for the special diet. I do know Neil Reynolds wrote in the Globe, I think it was yesterday, may have been today, that McGuinty should do the honest thing and declare Ontario bankrupt. Instead of picking pockets of the poor, but I'll add that, instead of picking pockets of the poor, he should just make the rich take their haircut.
And the funny thing is that they're pleading poverty. The government's pleading poverty on one hand, and going through with corporate tax cuts on the other. McGuinty's whole pro business strategy that he has now under the name of Open Ontario or Ontario Open for Business, or whatever it is, to create a kind of kinder, gentler, more pro business climate.
Mm-hmm. There's no doubt we need more jobs. We seem to be at the wrong end of the lever, pumping the poor people for the money. You know, grab the fulcrum by the long end, not the short end, the long end. Don't ask the people who don't have any money to fund your recovery. Surely you're more imaginative than that, but no, apparently not. $7 billion plus for Samsung and no details. No details. Refusal to release the details. And cuts to food for poor people.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I don't think we've seen anything quite like this. I mean, even Harris, by comparison, his cuts were draconian, but I don't think he really, singled out food. No? Said, well, we're gonna fund this recovery with the food we take away from the poor people. I think even Harris didn't do that. So this guy's acquiring, he's the horse of a different color now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, what did you conclude from all your research and your prior knowledge of this issue and this problem?
I think it shows. I mean, since the days of the Victorian poor laws in England, there's been a concern with this idea of the principle of less eligibility when it comes to welfare.
Right.
That is that you have to have assistance rates and conditions for people living on assistance that make the worst job in the labor market more attractive.
John Clark would say the same thing.
And he's right. And the special diet was one step, along with a broader fight towards increasing rates, was one step towards making life on assistance a little bit easier.
Yeah.
Nowhere near preferable to the worst job in the labor market.
Right.
But because it was that step, it was necessary for the government to come in and keep that principle of less eligibility in check. And how we respond as an anti-poverty movement and how we respond in terms of broader movement of women's groups and trade unions and other people and doctors who have been active around the special diet campaign and the poverty reduction campaign in general is something that we're going to have to see, in the, especially in the spring and leading up to this election.
Yeah, my own doctor has said to me, and I'll probably paint a target on my back by saying this, he said to me, have you got the special diet form yet? He says, yeah, I have other patients who are waiting for it. He says, I want you to bring that in here when you get it. And I may put a subtext to this interview by saying, if your doctor doesn't take that attitude, maybe you should reconsider your doctor because there's help available.
Right.
Yeah. Well,
right.
Are you, I know you don't consider yourself strictly a political commentator, but I think this is going to be an interesting election in the disposition of ridings and the numbers in the ridings that reflect McGuinty's punitive or almost thieving form of government. Are you interested when the election comes along in doing a early morning rundown of what the counts are and what the result is and why?
Sure.
Are you?
Yeah,
okay.
I'd love to do something
morning,
like that.
Morning person, okay. Well, if you can do it, I can do it, and we'll talk to you on October 7th and before about it. I appreciate you coming on the show today and giving us a little lighter insight into the dark things that have been going on with poor people in Ontario.
Thanks again for having me, Jeff.
All right, thanks, Simon.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These are not the full articles that we read to you. These are condensations of the articles that you can find in the newspapers that we identify on the show. First, world food prices hit another high. World food prices surged to a new historic peak in January for the seventh consecutive month, according to a closely watched food price index. The rise caused by severe weather, competition for crops from biofuels, and also rising oil prices has sparked riots in some parts of the world, including Egypt. It's also starting to hurt lower-income Canadians. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization said its food price index rose 3.4% over the previous month. At 231 points, this is the highest level since the organization started measuring food prices more than two decades ago. Canada's third largest food retailer, Metro Incorporated, predicted supermarket prices would begin rising in February, the Star reported. In certain categories, we're expecting some pretty significant increases, said Eric LaFleche, president and chief executive of Metro. LaFleche cited pasta and bread as examples. Canadians on low incomes feel the pain more deeply than average consumers, mainly because they spend a greater share of their household income on food. From our perspective, there's no question that price increases are certainly a factor in the number of people coming to the food bank, said Michael Oliphant, Director of Research and Communications for the Daily Bread Food Bank. The food bank saw demand rise 15% to 16% across the Greater Toronto Area last year to more than 1 million visits, mainly due to the economic downturn. And while donations of dried goods along with fruit and vegetables held up well, the food bank had to buy more meat to meet the demand, Oliphant said. Said social policy analyst John Stapleton, a member of the food bank's board, prices of dairy and other supply-managed foods, ones with marketing boards, have been rising faster than other foods in Canada. That by Dana Flavell in the Toronto Star. Are Arab states about to fall like Eastern Europe in 1989? Are the Arab states of the Middle East and North Africa about to experience what Central and Eastern Europe did in those heated months of 1989, a fast escalating domino fall cascade of regimes and leaders who found themselves stripped of all legitimacy in the face of crowds of indignant citizens? Asif Bayat, a sociologist who documented the grassroots street-level uprisings of Egypt and Syria in his book Life as Politics, How Ordinary People Changed the Middle East, said, while popular movements have similar causes and spontaneous tactics, they are facing a wildly different group of Arab leaders, united only by their authoritarianism. The two dozen Arab regimes range from pure monarchies and near totalitarian controls, such as Saudi Arabia, to self-described socialist states, such as Libya and Syria, to places such as Algeria and Lebanon, where more or less authoritarian regimes manipulate a nearly liberal state. Some, such as Tunisia and Libya, are largely secular, whereas the Persian Gulf states tend towards religious law. The other key difference may lie with the militaries. Mass uprisings do not usually turn into full-scale revolutions until the soldiers begin supporting the protesters rather than fighting them. In Tunisia, this happened very quickly. In many Arab states, the soldiers are drawn from the same communities as the young citizens who are protesting, a solidarity that led to the collapse of Europe's dictatorships in 89, and this time could determine the difference between liberation and violent crushing. That by Doug Saunders in the Globe and Mail. City Hall warned of more protests. The dozens of protesters who derailed Toronto's Budget Committee and turned City Hall's normally staid second floor into a loud, near-violent scuffle with police have a message for Mayor Rob Ford's administration. Get used to this, because there will be more. Members of several anti-poverty groups came to Budget Committee to argue against proposed cuts, but the committee meeting dissolved into a shouting match and a tense confrontation between protesters and Councillor Doug Ford, who was recorded by 680 News telling one man who approached him swearing and brandishing a telephone camera to get going, get a job. This was the first round of Rob Ford's devastating attacks being prepared, said OCAP organizer John Clark. He'd better understand that if he's going to destroy services on the scale he intends to do, it's going to involve a massive confrontation. Doug Ford said, "We aren't going to be intimidated. Simple. We're going to stay focused," he said. Mr. Ford also denied telling anyone to get a job, saying, "Show me on tape when I said that." OCAP member Lisa Schofield said they're in no mood to play nice. If you want to tell us to stand in a queue and wait and speak politely, that's bogus. We have the right to come in here, she said, clutching a plastic bag of ice cubes to her left wrist, alleging an officer had twisted her arm, taking her outside the committee room. This is the first real move that Ford is making to attack poor people in the city of Toronto. We're taking it very seriously. We're not going to wait to see what comes next. This first cut is enough for us. That by Anna Mailer Paperny in the Globe and Mail. McGuinty, be honest with voters and declare bankruptcy. By conscious and calculated design, Ontario's deficits will continue through 2017-18, by which time the province and the country could well be entering its next recession. Ontario almost certainly will not pay down any of its spiraling debt within the lifetime of most Ontarians. The Canadian Taxpayer Federation has aptly described this debt and deficit crisis as never-ending. In these circumstances, Ontario would be wise to consider bankruptcy, a strategic position championed for a number of European countries, Greece, Ireland, Portugal, by The Economist magazine. In an editorial, The Economist said this newspaper does not advocate the first rich country sovereign default in half a century lightly. But the logic for taking bankruptcy action sooner rather than later is powerful. The fact of the matter is this. McGuinty has essentially conceded default by postponing Ontario's debt repayment to the next generation. He is lucky that we no longer throw people into debtor's prison for this kind of crime. That by Neil Reynolds in Wednesday, February 9th's Globe and Mail. Patients to wait longer for joint replacements as surgeons told to take a break. One of Canada's leading orthopedic surgeons, Alan Gross, would rather be performing joint replacements on patients who have waited weeks and months, but instead he will take holidays he doesn't want. Dr. Gross and others in the Toronto Central Local Health Integrated Network is facing a cut in operating room time to do hip and knee replacements. His has been reduced by about half after government money to fund the surgery started to run short. Said Dr. Gross, along with two other Mount Sinai Hospital orthopedic surgeons, who will collectively be doing 10 joint replacements a week, down from 20, "We just came back from our big Christmas break. The last thing we need is a holiday." At issue is the way joint replacement operations are paid, through incentive funds provided by the province. The incentives, $6,882 for each hip or knee patient at community hospitals, and $8,930 for those at teaching hospitals, have helped whittle wait times with patients viewed as sources of revenue. With many hospitals hitting or nearing their target number of operations before the end of this fiscal year, on March the 31st, joint replacements costing $10,000 to $12,000 are now seen as a financial drain, as the money to fund them must come out of a hospital's global budget. Yet the federal government has high hopes for the fund, initiated in 2004 to cut waiting times in five designated procedures: hip and knee replacements, cataract surgery, heart operations, diagnostic imaging, and cancer radiotherapy. Federal waiting time funding, however, is slated to evaporate in 2013 to 2014. NDP health critic Franche Gélinas called the situation ludicrous. "We have highly trained, skilled professionals. We have ORs. We have hospital support," she said in a phone interview, "and all of this will go idle." At Mount Sinai, operating rooms will be filled with other cases, Dr. Gross said. That by Lisa Priest in the Globe and Mail. HUDAC keeps positions open on healthcare premium. Ontario PC leader Tim HUDAC has not yet revealed what he would do differently if he wins the election on October 6th. Mr. HUDAC's refusal to clarify where he stands on the health premium, which costs Ontario taxpayers up to $900 each per year, was in stark contrast with a statement released by his office. Ontario PC leader Tim HUDAC has been very clear, the statement said. If elected premier, he would not cut the health tax or Ontario's health care budget. The statement, titled "Minister of Health Lies to Nurses," was issued in response to a campaign-style speech Health Minister Deb Matthews gave Thursday when she told nurses Mr. HUDAC would eliminate the health premium. Mr. HUDAC would not comment on why his office had a different stand from his own. That was a rare misstep for a leader renowned for staying on message. Karen Hallett with that story from the Globe and Mail. Once again, in tribute to Gary Moore, moving on.
far behind. We're moving on. We're moving on. Well, I've been hanging on too long. I'm still on my way.
And in a column that hits a little closer to home. Too many transit drivers, snug in their seats, are heedless of the obstacles presented to passengers. I once broke my ankle dismounting a TTC bus and spilling into a heap of crusty snow. As I lay there writhing, imploring the driver for help, he trundled off on his merry way. I limped across the road and thumbed a ride to the nearest hospital emergency room. Was on crutches for a month. I resent the emphasis put on passengers by cops and the TTC to prevent calamities, as they did in advance of the most recent fart in a mitten snowstorm. Anybody hear a word of caution aimed at drivers? Numbers provided by TTC spokesperson Brad Ross reveal the following about serious accidents involving pedestrians and buses. 2007, 31 injuries, 2 fatalities. 2008, 26 injuries. 1 fatality, a drop. 2009, dramatic rise to 35 injuries, but 0 fatalities. 2010, 34 injuries and 3 fatalities. For 2010 and the 3 fatalities thus far this year, no charges have been laid against operators. That doesn't mean drivers were not contributors to the accidents that occurred, just that they weren't legally culpable or warning charges in the estimation of police. When a 17-year-old youth was killed last August, run over and trapped by a bus traveling east on Lakeshore Boulevard, the victim had been jaywalking. This should not get you killed on urban streets congested with sluggish vehicular traffic. Witnesses reported that a throng of young people had been leaving a bush party at Woodbine Beach. This driver had apparently been doing 50. Surely he must have seen the horde, upwards of 1,000 teens dispersing directly to his right. Prudence demands he should have proceeded more gingerly with minimum speed. I'm still waiting for an explanation as to how an electrical worker came to be killed this past Christmas Day when a TTC bus sheared off his truck's cherry picker on Bathurst Street. Who misjudges to such calamitous degree the proximity of a cherry picker? And while some drivers are certainly pleasant and polite, I watched one of the busy Queen Street route Saturday leave his seat to help an old lady exit. A great many are, frankly, rude, thoughtless, cantankerous, and easily provoked to annoyance. You can't be that impatient, that misanthropic in a public service job. And you shouldn't be that incautious when commanding a moving behemoth that weighs up to 40,000 pounds. Rather than defensive driving, we get defensive posturing. That by Rosie DeMeno in the Toronto Star. And a story of efficiency for a former Hamilton resident. Emily Green followed her walker out of the elevator at 7:30 in the morning. She was squinting, but not because of the light. Her vision is a generous 6%. She has no depth perception. She zipped her parka in anticipation of the cold. Emily lives in the west end of Toronto past Kipling Station. Most days she goes to work on Wheel-Trans, but some days she rides the Lambton bus, and now that route is in peril. No, Emily is in peril. You know the story of the Lambton bus, even if you haven't heard of it until now. It is not a priority. It has low ridership at night on the weekends, so it does not fit the Ford Stintz model of efficiency. Here is efficiency. Emily does daily piecework assembling and packaging at Cornbrook Enterprises, a workshop on Trithewey, just off Black Creek Drive. Her workplace is a long way from her home. I followed her to the bus stop. She pushed her walker over the icy, unsteady sidewalks. Emily is originally from Hamilton. She lives in community housing. Of the Lambton bus, she said it's weekends and holidays after 10 that's being canceled. Her thoughts? There's a driver who does the late-night runs. He and a few others have helped me. We've had a long talk. They've taught me the area. Those drivers, the TTC at its best. Emily's alternatives if the route is cut? She doesn't have any. The subway is dangerous for me. There are a lot of stairs, and to get to it, you have to go under a subway bridge. There are no markings, and not all the street crossings are audible. Unsafe, therefore, for her. The bus came then, a kneeler, easier to board than a regular bus. We found seats up front. This bus is my baby. It goes through poor areas, nice areas, semi-industrial areas. Late nights, there's workers who go home. I think the rider counts are off. I don't think counts are important. I am with her. There are not many grocery stores in her neighborhood. We passed the supermarkets on Dundas near Jane. She said in passing, there's no bus stop here. Oh, for the love of... We got off at the corner so Emily could head north. She said the Lambton bus is my main connection to Kipling, an accessible station. Take that, Ford stints. And in our good news story this week, newspaper is now bouncing back. As recently as last year, the industry was shuddering from 2009's stomach-churning plunge in advertising revenues, which cratered after the onset of the global financial crisis. Having not endured a crisis of this order since Gutenberg, the industry took on the appearance of a man with his hair on fire and trying to put it out with a hammer. But in hyper-crowded cyberspace, the advantage has gone to the most familiar tribunes. That would include the 164-year-old Chicago Tribune, which, like almost every daily in North America, has continued to earn profits through the industry's worst hours. Indeed, industry warhorses The New York Times, Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal, and even Tribune have reported profit gains in the past year. In the past 12 months, shares in North America's top 10 publicly traded newspaper firms have gained an average of 20.8%, and that's before any meaningful recovery in ad revenues or significant migration of print advertisers to online. And ahead of the Times' second experiment later this year with trying to charge for selected online content. That's a feat the Wall Street Journal and Financial Times have pulled off, and that Murdoch's general interest papers are now attempting. Not long into the Internet's brief history, users were contemplating that trying to get a drink from the web is like sipping from a fire hydrant. That growing flood of information is a boon to traditional newspapers. They alone have the expertise to quickly collect and verify staggering amounts of data and present it in reader-friendly format. We'll hear soon enough about the phoenix-like rebirth of newspapers. It will be a crock since there were no ashes to rise from, but editors will enjoy handling those reports far more than the industry obits they've edited the past few years. And that by David Olive, business columnist in the Toronto Star. And we have just one announcement for you before we conclude the news. The CRTC wants web feedback. The CRTC is calling for public feedback on its controversial policy on usage-based internet billing. Such a plan would allow providers to charge heavy internet users more money. The federal telecom regulator said last week it would delay a reform that was originally to take effect on March 1st while a policy is reviewed. And that's all the news we have this week at Disrespect. But come back next week. There will be more. And a last tribute to Gary Moore, this show, The Stumble. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.